what you can think, that perhaps because you have turbulence, and turbulence is clustering quite often, that whether they, that actually comes from Raymond's paper, whether Cloud Michael scale actually looks like that, where you start, and this is basically DNS for stocks number one particles, not non-sedimenting, and we will get back to this non-sedimenting, why it's actually not a very good model. The question is, if this is when you start with, after some time, those particles tend to cluster, and this is basically DNS for common log scale is somewhere like that. So this is basically well-resolved behavior. And the question is, if you think about this, whether Cloud Michael scale look like that. So that's kind of the first thing that you may ask yourself, whether this is how clouds look like on the very small scale. And I would argue that they do not really. And this comes from a paper that Jean-Louis and then his student put together, looking at distribution of randomness, if you like, of a distribution of droplets as they fly through a cloud with a device that counts droplet by droplet, and then basically plotting the results and comparing it to the basically random or Poisson statistics for various spatial scales. So this is 2 millimeters, 4 millimeters, so on and so forth. These are larger scales. And there is a reason why at larger scales you may expect sort of more deviation, because you don't expect clouds to be completely homogeneous at those scales for various reasons. But as you can see, this is relatively random. If there's anything that is different from randomness, it's really not that important. So the point is that if you think about clouds, this is not the picture that you should keep in mind. This is the picture that you should keep in mind. And you may ask yourself, why it is so? Why it is so? And the reason is that, as I already alluded to, that there is a Stokes number that tells you the response time versus the Kolmogorov time scale. So another, that tells you, basically describes the particle inertia, the effect of particle inertia, the droplet response time, versus the Kolmogorov time scale. But that's not the only parameter that matters. There's another parameter that is actually more important, I would argue, which is the sedimentation parameter that tells you what is the ratio between the particle sedimentation versus the Kolmogorov velocity. So you can think about this as, if this parameter is very small, that means that droplets or particles are not sedimenting very rapidly comparing to the Kolmogorov velocity scale. But if this parameter is large, that means that this sedimentation is important. So if you take values for clouds, so what this and of course the parameter that is kind of important if you think about this is the eddy dissipation, the small scale dissipation rate, because the Kolmogorov time scale and Kolmogorov velocity scale basically depend on the TKE dissipation, on the epsilon. So if you just, and it comes from the paper, actually a comment to Ray's paper actually, if you look at different droplet sizes, 5, 15, 25, that's the sedimentation velocity, that's the response time, and then on the other axis I have eddy dissipation rate from kind of relatively small to a little bit larger ones. And this is basically the values that typically was kind of thought of spanning the range encountered with clouds. There may be some very small volumes that this ratio is considerably, this value is considerably higher, but kind of typically we tend to think that this will be more on kind of like a stratocumulus cloud, not very turbulent. This will be a value typical for, at least in the mean, for cumulus clouds. So if you like the C, whatever the CGS units, this will be 1 and this will be 100 centimeters squared per second cube. And now this is the Kolmogorov velocity scale and Kolmogorov time scale. And for these various combinations, you get basically values given like that. But if you just look at this value, this is the Stokes, the Stokes number is relatively small. Maybe here is 2%. if you take smaller dissipation rate and smaller droplets, it's even smaller. For larger dissipation rates and larger droplets, it's actually larger. But the point is not necessarily what the value is, but the point that, that the Stokes number is much smaller than the sedimentation number. So that tells you that these droplets are basically falling relatively quickly, as I already said, through the through those whatever small scale turbulence you would have. And then, of course, a lot of interest of clouds was motivated by some early laboratory experiments with particle element flow, which was actually showing that there is a very pronounced, very important preferential concentration. In other words, those experiments would suggest that perhaps clouds on small scales look like that rather than like that. And the reason why this is not so is that if you look at these values of the dissipation rate, this is not what typical laboratory experiment had. If you take typical laboratory experiment, which would have maybe two or three orders of magnitude higher dissipation rate, then as you can see, this, these two, for the same droplets sizes, these parameters are kind of reversed. In other words, the Stokes number is relatively large, and the sedimentation parameter is much smaller. And the whole point is that if you do the math, the ratio between the two is proportional to the dissipation rate in the power of three quarters for the Stokes limits. For the other limits, I mean, if you go beyond Stokes, that will not hold exactly, but for Stokes limit, that's exactly what it is. And the point is that this ratio then depends on the dissipation rate. So this basically tells you that if you have high dissipation rate, this ratio will be relatively large. In other words, Stokes one number will dominate and the sedimentation parameter will be small. So that's my explanation that we put in the paper. Why in the regime of laboratory experiments you see preferential concentration, and why we don't see it in experiments in clouds?
Can I make a comment before you go
on? Sure.
So what you're saying is reasonable, but there's one, you know, maybe subtlety that is a little bit that needs to be taken into account when you interpret these numbers. Stokes number, so if you take the phenomenon of preferential concentration, it becomes most pronounced when Stokes number is one.
Yeah, okay.
Whereas if you look at settling parameter, gravitational effects become dominant when the settling parameter is much greater than one. So it's not fair to just compare the numbers, you know, and say one's small and one's large, because they really have different, right?
Yeah,
one phenomenon peaks when
one
is on the order of one, and the other phenomenon peaks when the other is on the order of 10 or 100.
Yeah, I have no problem. My point.
And you have no problem, but you just finished reaching a conclusion that was incorrect based on those numbers.
Well, I mean, the reason why I'm showing that is kind of pedagogical, if you like. I would like to argue that a lot of interest from the turbulence community came from laboratory experiments where preferential concentration was really strongly observed. And I think that's why people argue, well, then the clouds should look like that. And that's basically the reason why that's not the case. Because parameter space for laboratory experiments and for clouds are different. We're talking about different regimes, if you like.
They're different regimes, but it's not quite right to say that one is inertially, that the cloud regime is completely gravitationally dominated, right? I mean, gravity is still...
I'm not saying that. I'm saying why... I'm trying to explain why clouds don't look like that. You know, some people are motivated. I mean, you are clearly one of those, because this picture comes from your paper and some turbulence people that influence your thinking. But I'm saying that this is not how cloud microscale look like. And my explanation is that this is basically why. That this kind of laboratory experiment parameter space is different than cloud physics. And I agree with your details, but I think this is quite a real comment.
I guess we can have a discussion at the end, maybe, on this subject.
Yeah.
This is
something goes on here from this thing. Okay. So, but basically the point that I'm making is the turbulence in clouds is at least on the mean. I mean, you can find regions, very small regions that are, because you get, you have a distribution of the local dissipation rate. But at least on the average, turbulence are much weaker in clouds than it is in laboratory. And that makes, this makes droplet sedimentation significantly more important. And makes the high turbulence make droplet sedimentation not so important in laboratory experiments. That's why initial studies kind of targeting clouds, including actually your study, was done without effects of sedimentation. And we've been arguing from the very beginning with Paul when he was doing his thesis, I will show some of his results soon, that we need to include sedimentation, because otherwise we're not looking at clouds, but we're looking at some artificial systems that don't really have no relevance to clouds. Okay, now, I'm not saying that preferential concentration doesn't exist, because if you look at the vorticity field, and with the same vorticity field, you get basically snapshots of droplet positions for three-dimensional, this is 3D, just cut through it, for different droplet sizes. I don't specifically remember how Paul, in his dissertation, came up with snapshots with the same flow field. I'm not sure whether he saved flow field and then put droplets in. But the point here is, and this is what kind of we would think would be like a typical eddy dissipation rate, turbulent dissipation rate for clouds. The point here is that if you go to larger and larger droplets, this, which kind of looks more random than this one, with those high vorticity basically having empty spaces, droplets are expelled from those cores, if you like. And just by naked eye, you can tell that there is kind of more randomness here than it is here. And that's consistent with the role droplet size plays. So in other words, yes, there is some preferential concentration, but it's much smaller than what one would expect based on those simulations without considering droplet sedimentation. But these simulations were done with sedimentation, and for small one, as you can kind of imagine, or as you can see, that there is some effect, but not very pronounced. And if you go to larger and larger droplets, the effect is larger. Now, the question you may ask, and that's what I got interested in that, and actually was involved with Paul with his dissertation, whether this preferential concentration has some effect on the width of the spectrum. In other words, you would expect that if you have because of course turbulence or small scale turbulence means that you would have fluctuation of the supersaturation. That's what drives the diffusional growth of droplets. And the question that we've been looking at is whether this has some effect on droplet growth. And I don't want to go into details, but if you just look at this figure, that shows how with time the width of the droplet spectrum changes, how it increases for some, this is number of seconds, so I mean perhaps you would feel more comfortable if you would non-dimensionalize that, but I told Paul that this is it's a complex problem, and we actually need to think about real time rather than non-dimensionalized, because there will be just too many many parameters there. Well, the point is that if you look how big this width of the spectrum is, it's really tiny. It's fraction of the percent. So from this work, Paul concluded that the small scale turbulence has very small effect. And we're talking about the DNS of relatively small box, so you can say, well, there is of course a limitation of that, because if you would go to larger domain, have a bigger range of Reynolds number, maybe those fluctuations will get bigger and you would eventually see some stronger effect. Now, so the question is, what about those DNS limitations? And the argument here is that if you increase Reynolds number, in other words, do larger and larger range of scales, the question is, can those fluctuations increase without any limit? In other words, can they grow and grow and grow? And that would, of course, bring some wider and wider spectra, because each droplet will experience perhaps different histories, and that will provide a spreading, if you like. Well, the point is that this is only true for some point, and in cloud physics we are well aware that there is a natural break on the supersaturation fluctuations, and this break comes from basically the nature of the supersaturation. So if you think about the evolution equations for the temperature and moisture in the cloud, you can write a supersaturation equation that is that comes with them. In other words, supersaturation is the ratio of the water vapor pressure over the saturated value. So it involves both how much water vapor locally you have and also what is the local temperature. So you need to combine these two equations, and if you do this, then you will end up with the equation that looks like that. This is your source term, which basically tells you that your supersaturation will increase with the vertical velocity, which is basically because this is a stratified environment, which is the atmosphere. If the parcel rises, it expands, and then the rate it rises gives you the forcing term for the supersaturation. But at the same time, droplets grow, they release latent heat that increases the temperature and of course consume water vapor. So this is the latent heating term, which is proportional to the supersaturation itself and then has a phase relaxation timescale at the bottom. So the point is that in the, if you think about this equation, then of course you may ask what will happen when the supersaturation tendency goes to zero. In other words, if you think quasi-equilibrium, and then this quasi-equilibrium is basically given by this value, but that's not the point. The point is, what is the phase relaxation timescale? Because if it's very quick, that means that you will not allow supersaturation to grow to some big values. And in a paper published some time ago that gives, this is the radius, this is droplet concentration, and the duration, I mean, it spans quite a bit. I mean, it goes probably close to 3 orders of magnitude. But the point is that clouds, typical cloud values are on this diagonal. In other words, when the concentration is smaller, droplets are typically larger. When the concentration is large, droplets are typically smaller. So these are kind of extreme values, but typically your real cloud physics will be somewhere here. So this value, you may say, is perhaps maybe a second, maybe a small fraction a second, a large fraction, whatever, a few tenths of a second, or maybe just a few seconds. So the point is that if you think about the range of scales, the point is that for any Swift timescale larger than this quasi-equilibrium timescale, you may expect that supersaturation will be basically limited to this value. So in other words, this equation tells you that the balance between the forcing and the latent heating will tend to produce values of the quasi-equilibrium once you go beyond, let's say, scale of some meters, because with 1 second time scale, what scales, what spatial scales you would have that will have the turnover time of about a second. I would think that this may be maybe a fraction of a meter, or maybe 1 meter, maybe 10 meters. So the point is I would expect that if you do the DNS over a box, let's say, of 10 meters, you would see that supersaturation fluctuations will have this natural break and will not keep increasing, as some people argue. And of course, if you don't have this term, you only work with this equation, then of course this break is gone. And you will see that if you go to larger and larger eddies, then those fluctuations will keep growing because the vertical velocity with larger eddies would be larger. So you have to keep this in mind that this is the natural break inside cloud physics. So then the argument is that okay, small scales don't have much effect, but if you start thinking about larger and larger scales, they will not have the effect because of this break. Okay. Now, but so far,
isn't that also a mean field argument again? This equation, in some sense, it doesn't.
Alpha W fluctuates.
Well, I mean, yeah. I don't know what you mean by that, but what I'm saying is that. Yeah, so you would have small scales fluctuate. I mean, this equation is valid across all scales, am I right? So if you have multi-scale environment, I don't know what exactly will fall out of it. Maybe that's an exercise worth pursuing. But what I'm saying is,
I don't expect the supersaturation fluctuations to, let's say, grow with some power of Reynolds number, as some people argue. And I perhaps should bring it. Well, I think this was actually not published because I kind of wrote the review saying, well, this is not what happens in clouds, and it was actually, it didn't make it to the final paper. I will not use names, although people are not in this room, so I can probably do this. but I will not. No, the point is that
technically it does not work on any scale, because if you have a S which depends on scale, on coordinates, then you would have a diffusion term. Here you assume that all the heat that you release just uniformly released and hits a given volume. But generally it's not like this. S is a complicated field in space, and this is the equation averaged over space.
Yeah.
So it's a mean field, what York says,
but
which disregards fluctuations. Special.
But we know that because this is really diluted, cloud is really diluted in terms of droplets, how they are spatially distributed. And the volume affected by latent heating is really, again, maybe 10 radii, which is still much smaller than the distance between droplets. So that's why we actually can do, and we showed it with Paul, that's why you actually can do DNS with droplets looking at the condensational growths. Because you don't have to resolve gradients near the droplets, which drive the growths. Because this volume that is affected by these processes are really relatively small to the distance between, I mean, the distance that is affected is small comparing to distances. So the picture is, this is your droplet, this is the other droplet. The volume affected by growth of these droplets is kind of like that, and it is still far away from the other droplet. So you can think that supersaturation over, let's say, a Kolmogorov length scale has a good meaning. You don't have to worry about what happens at those tiny scales near the droplet, because that's one-tenth of the, let's say, Kolmogorov scale. So everything is...
I'd rather say that this is an argument that this is a strongly fluctuating field, so for different droplets it has
different
because they're so far apart.
Yeah,
then you can treat it as something which characterizes your cloud or any volume.
Yes,
this is a strongly fluctuating field. The droplets would be growing in a very different environment. They would have very wide distribution over sizes.
No, they
would be another effect, but definitely don't assume.
No. I'm saying that, well, again, you can argue that whatever we done 20 years ago with DNS was kind of still relatively low Reynolds number, but we look into this, and fluctuations, yes, they are, but they are not very big. And droplets width, as I showed you before, the spectrum is, the width is really tiny. I mean, there's no way you can actually measure a width which is, you know, a tiny fraction of a micron. And that's not what we observe in clouds, let me put it this way. So there must be something else going on, and now I will actually try to convince you that there is another mechanism which will work, because for small scales we know that it doesn't, and in larger scales, just looking at the kind of homogeneous on the average, it doesn't work either, because you have this break on the supersaturation fluctuation. So in other words, the argument that the high Reynolds number turbulence will give you higher supersaturation is not, in my mind, is not correct either. So within this uniform cloud, so let's say, think about the adiabatic core. Let's say, some people would argue that nothing like that exists, but think about the volume that goes through a cloud-based active-based droplet. As I said, fluctuations of the supersaturation have small effects. So my point is, we need to look for something else to explain what we see in clouds. And my argument is, okay, before I get the argument, this is one way to think about this problem. And actually, I haven't said what I needed to say is what Paul, his results were basic. The argument that he had was that if you look at the snapshot, yes, you have droplets which are close together, so this will be growing slower because there is a competition for the water vapor. Droplets that are the volume that is void of droplets, of course, supersaturation will increase because you get, in those volumes, you only get this term. But the point is that if you look at the same picture a moment later, droplets will have different positions. So in other words, everything averages out, and that's why we don't see much effect. So the point here is that the conversational growth is kind of reversible. Droplets grow more in the higher supersaturation, but then they grow less in the lower supersaturation. And the two are kind of changing rapidly. And that was the main conclusion from Paul's study, is that you have to account for the fact that you cannot think about this problem keeping in mind that you will have lucky droplets all the time. You may have them for a moment, and then they will be not so lucky. And the idea here is that this is kind of reversible. In other words, they grow and then they grow less. But this effect will have effect for collisional growth that I will talk about later. So let's now put this aside. But this collisional growth, of course, is not reversible. When they collide and you make one droplet out of the two, then they stay as a larger droplet. So perhaps this is a one way to think about this problem. Now let's go back to this uniform cloud. So there, as I argued, the fluctuations of the supersaturation are relatively small, but what about the impact of mixing with the environment? So this is what we call entrainment, and this, I believe, has really a fundamental effect. So in other words, that is related to turbulence, because of course this we're talking about turbulent entrainment. And that's what I think is the key. So when I say entrainment, okay, this is the cloud that you may actually see through the window if you look outside on a day different than today. So how these clouds work is that this is the cloud base, so the air is coming from the bottom. Droplets are activated here, so that's the activation zone, if you like. And then we have environment which is relatively non-turbulent, if you like. It may be a little bit if there are some remnants of previous clouds, but typically it's relatively non-turbulent. And then you have those instabilities at the edges of the cloud that I studied some time ago, and there are papers on that. And they drive the turbulence inside the cloud. So now, if you would think about a small volume somewhere near the top of the cloud, and you ask the question, where these droplets come from, they make actually have a different histories, and that's basically the whole point. So this issue about entrainment and mixing and its effect on cloud droplet spectra have kind of several layers, if you like, of relevant processes. So one is that, of course, entrainment and mixing leads to the evaporation of cloud water. I mean, you have a cloud, and you bring dry air, then typically it means that you would evaporate cloud water. And the question is, how does evaporation affect the spectrum of cloud droplets? So that's one thing. Now, the other thing is that you entrain air, you entrain new cloud condensation nuclei. So you may actually activate new cloud droplets above the cloud base. So what I'm thinking about is that if this is sort of the eddy that kind of brings the air into the cloud here or here, you may activate new droplets. And I will have some results. I think I'm doing way too slow. And then the entrainment mixing also provides large-scale source of turbulence. And this may seem irrelevant for droplet growth, but I will try to convince you that the fact that this is turbulent environment, which comes from entrainment mixing, which actually brings these two together, this is important. So let me quickly review these two, and then we will go to the third one. So the fact how we evaporate cloud droplets due to mixing. So think about this like that. This is the edge of a cloud. This is what we think it should look like, with basically filaments of dry air when this mixing progresses. And you can think about kind of different mixing processes. One would be what we would call an extremely inhomogeneous mixing, when these droplets initially are filling the volume. Now you take some of them completely and the rest doesn't change the size at all. So this is what we would call extremely inhomogeneous mixing. Now, in the homogeneous situation, you may think that these droplets, all of them, will evaporate in the same, will lose the same mass. In other words, the conditions are homogeneous over the box, and the droplets respond to this homogeneous condition. So, if you think what actually controls whether the mixing goes this way or the other way, it's relatively simple, because the argument is that if you have this volume, let's say, imagine if we start with a fully clouded half of the volume and the rest is cloud free, if you would mix it mechanically or stir it rapidly and then allow droplets to evaporate, then you will end up with mixing like that. So in other words, high turbulent mixing and then slow droplet evaporation will follow homogeneous mixing. In the opposite limit, if you just don't mix it at all, just allow droplets to evaporate near the interface, for example, through the molecular diffusion, only those near the edges of this initial separation boundary will evaporate and the rest will not be affected. So the limit where the turbulence intensity is low and droplets evaporate rapidly, that's the extremely inhomogeneous mixing term. So the ratio between the two, which is sometimes called one or the one over it, the Domkoller number for the, you know, what is chemical literature, I think, or turbulence chemical reactions. It's basically the question of the evaporation time scale versus the mixing time scale. For the evaporation, this is the one that we use. Actually, I should have the author of the paper here, but it goes back almost 40 years, I think, to papers by John Latham and Marshall Baker. These are kind of cloud physicists. And so we can actually come up with a different scale. I think Ray has a different scale that he usually put the phase relaxation time scale, rather than looking at the relative humidity of the air and so on and so forth. And then the turbulent mixing time scale is basically the eddy size divided by the velocity. And if you apply the scaling, then that's the number that you have. So the only inconvenience here is that there is really a length scale here. In other words, the volume that you're working with. And I guess this is why Raymond was suggesting that we should look at the, rather than applying scale, we should think about what is the scale that the ratio of those scales is close to one. That's kind of another way of thinking, rather than bringing the scale, which of course we don't know, into this mechanism. So, but if you fly through a cloud like that, this is the same cloud as I had in the previous picture, then the question is what you would see. And then, of course, the problem is that the aircraft flies 100 meters a second, and the instruments have to be really, really good to do this. And only recently, we had things like Actos that you can drag with the chopper with much slower speed and look at those scales with more confidence. So this is pretty old data, probably early 80s, so we're talking 30 years. But already, if you just look at this data. So what we're looking at? We're looking at the cut through a cloud, kind of like what I showed here. You basically cut through a cloud, and then you look how much water you have, you look at the vertical velocity, and you look at the droplet spectra. And the caveat here is that this is really looking, so aircraft flies 100 meters a second, this is 5 seconds, so this is about 500 meters. And then early 80s, we're looking at the instruments that perhaps can look at things reliably with maybe over, let's say, 1 second, what we would say, 1 hertz data. So we're talking about 100 meters averages. So, of course, there's a lot of scales beneath 100 meters down to the Kolmogorov scale, which is like a millimeter, as I said. But nevertheless, you see some features that I'm highlighting here. First of all, this is close to, I'm not sure that that's adiabatic or not, but this is the highest liquid water content, so arguably this is the closest you can get to the adiabatic. In other words, going through the cloud base without any dilution. I should point here, this is the cloud water. And of course it's coming up. So this may be your adiabatic droplet peak, but as you can see, there are some smaller droplets. So where did these come from? They had to be either activated not far from this level, or droplets that evaporated from the peak, okay? And the same here. Now, this is the region when you get significant dilution. Nevertheless, the peak is kind of a similar position than the other one. So that tells me that this is perhaps the mark, if you like, of the inhomogeneous mixing. In other words, you change the concentration because the peak is lower, but you keep sizes in a similar position, and then you get all the other things that are going on here. So this is what you see when you fly through a cloud. Well, maybe I skipped that for the interest of time, but the point of next few slides was that we can actually look at this homogeneity of mixing in the DNS, doing a large number of simulations and trying to deduce what kind of a mixing you expect. But I think that I better skip that before I get to things that are of interest. So let me just finish that from those DNS you can come up with some approaches that I think we can use in large eddy simulation. In other words, not looking at the box maybe physically like that, but looking at the single cloud with a grid length that is maybe tens of meters, so they're still far away from the Kolmogorov scale. And then you can use some of the relationship that DNS suggests, and I will not go into details what this figure really showing, besides just telling you that it kind of mixes the expectation. In other words, there is some relationship between the homogeneity of mixing as deduced by the slope of some of this way we represent the mixing and the ratio of the time scale. So this is kind of something that we now thinking about how to use it in LES. So I will not tell you more, but go quickly through the next bullet, which is that you can have activation of new droplets above the cloud base. And why is that important? Well, it is important because if you look, this is the paper actually both these papers deal with relatively recent experiments in the Caribbean 2-3 years ago called RICO, rain in cumulus over ocean. What it shows, it's basically, this is from Hermann Gerber's paper, some averages of the different flights, we're going higher and higher into the cloud field and cutting through many clouds and basically gathering statistics. And this is what is referred to as the adiabatic liquid water content. In other words, how much water you expect to see if you would basically take an air parcel and rise it higher and higher, and this is on average how much you encounter. So as you can see, typically you would have significantly less liquid water than the adiabatic one, maybe 20%, maybe less higher up, more closer to the cloud base, but it's typically a relatively small fraction. But if you look at the droplet concentration actually increases with height, except for the very last, which you can argue it's kind of near cloud top when dilution really takes over. But it's kind of constant or maybe slightly increasing with height. So that's one analysis of the observation. This is another one which shows different days, and the picture is kind of the same. So this is just the mean. There is actually more information here because we're looking not only at the mean, which is kind of this white, small white line here, but we're looking at the basically distribution. So of course distribution is relatively wide or very wide, but the mean is kind of either constant or slightly increasing with height. Okay, and of course, because this is aircraft data, that's why you don't have much vertical resolution, because you just sample the cloud field at some level. So now the question is, as I said, we know that the water, cloud water is diluted, so how, and this is basically a numerical simulation, which tells you shows that this is the adiabatic cloud water, this is the mean cloud, and the width comes from different models. So this is actually like 12 or 15 models that were involved in modeling the comparison, larger simulation models. And those least diluted, which they call core, But it's still diluted. So how it is possible that you dilute cloud water but you don't dilute droplet concentration? And of course the argument is that it has to be through the in-cloud activation that this happens. So we have to think about additional source of cloud droplets above the cloud base when you activate new droplets. And again, in the interest of time, I had some simulations that show that this really happens. This picture doesn't show very nice. This is the CloudSphere. One simulation is when we don't allow droplet activation above the cloud base. The other one, when the activation happens, and this basically shows you that in the CloudSphere you get this kind of a patchy pattern, if you like, where activation happens. These dark colors shows you the areas where there is significant droplet activation. So in the CloudSphere you get the cloud base activation, and then above the cloud base you still have activation in different regions of this cloud. So, but I will not talk about this beyond just telling you that what we think is going on, that those eddies, and this goes back to a study that I've done with Jean-Louis Brenguier some time ago. This is basically a small cloud simulation. You can see those kind of entraining eddies, and at the edges of these eddies, you get the air that comes into the cloud. So this is this volume, and this complicated picture shows you the droplet spectra. So you get an eddy that kind of goes like that. This is your updrop that comes from the cloud base, and then you get this eddy here. You bring the fresh air and you activate them. And of course you cannot see this activation happening here, but if you enlarge it, this is this entrance of the dry air. You can see that these are small droplet spectra in each panel, and you can see that there is this is the peak that comes kind of similar to the one coming from the cloud base, but there is additional peak at small droplets. So that's your fresh activation, if you like. So let me skip a few slides just showing that it is important, and basically bringing out the picture that rather than activating at the cloud base and then, you know, living with this number that you have, you actually bring new droplets. So this is how traditionally people, I think, thought about cloud physics. This is, I think, what we need to think beyond that. Now about this entrainment mixing, providing large-scale source of cloud turbulence, and I said, you may think that this is irrelevant, but I think it is relevant because of process that I call, this is basically the study that Al Cooper thought about more than 30 years ago, I think, or maybe 25 years ago. And then that was the Sonia's PhD thesis, and then Alan Blythe, my colleague from Leeds, was involved with this study. And it's actually quite interesting because there is also a paper written by turbulence community quite recently. Professor Ricks was involved with that, basically showing relevance of this thinking. And I coined the term, I'm not sure whether you like it. I like it. I call it large eddy hopping, which is when you do island hopping, or you go to Greece for vacation and you do island hopping, which means you go on a ferry to one island, you spend some time on that island, then you go to another island, spend some time on that island, and so on. So I call it large eddy hopping, and the idea is that when you think about a droplet spectrum observed in one place in a cloud, let's say somewhere above the cloud base, these droplets may come through different histories, and some of them will go one path, if you like, which will involve some large eddies, and then the other one will go through other. So that's what I call large eddy hopping. In other words, droplets will hop large eddies. So you need large scales to provide different droplet activation and growth histories, but also you need small scales to allow hopping. In other words, droplets will hop from one eddy to another through small scale processes. And as I said, there is, so this, I will show you some results from real cloud simulations, but this paper was really done using two-dimensional synthetic turbulence. And it's two-dimensional because you need a wide range of scales. And you can only achieve such a wide range in numerical simulation if you go into two-dimensional turbulence. And probably also because you use synthetic, so it's, you know, dynamics is quick. It has, of course, some limitations, but if you would like to understand why these processes are important and how they are important, I think this is one way to go. And that brings me back to the point that I made at the beginning, that the small scales themselves are not important. So if you increase the range on Trumbull range, you will not get much. But if you start thinking about different histories and entrainment mixing is part of it, then you may actually gain quite a bit. So I actually copied Al Cooper's notes, I mean slides, that from seminar that he had not that long ago, and actually had to do with coalescence, initiation of coalescence. And I will not be talking about that specifically, but just to show you that for the diffusional growth, that eddy, what I call large eddy hopping, is actually the key. So this is a numerical simulation. So what they've done, they first run a cloud model, and this is basically a time evolution of one cloud. And then this is a relatively standard cloud model. It doesn't have a droplet of, I mean, the spectrum of cloud, but it's just what we call a bulk cloud model. In other words, telling you how much water you have, so on and so forth. But then you select a point, and then you, assuming that this is a turbulent environment, the model predicts turbulent kinetic energy, you can actually think about family of trajectories that end up in one point. And that's what they've done. So for example, in a point like that, you have a several trajectories, many trajectories that, because of the randomness, may end up not only cutting the cloud base at different positions, but also, this picture doesn't show it, but you may have some trajectories that kind of go and then are entrained again, go out and come back, if you like, with new activation. So that's how you can arguably produce small droplets at descent. So if you actually do this and look at the effects, how important that is. So just to compare it to some reference, let's this reference to be the basically adiabatic ascent from the cloud base. So you take in this trajectory model takes a realistic spectrum of aerosols and basically allow them to activate, and some of them will grow, some of them will stay unactivated. So if this is just this adiabatic ascent, this is kind of the spectrum that you will have. It's extremely narrow. It's extremely narrow. I would argue that probably you will not find such a narrow spectrum in a cloud, because it's just possible. And it, because that, well, that's the other point, is not so important, but there's also collision coalescence included in the simulation. So you get those additional peaks that are basically a multiplication of this peak. So you get collisions that happens even for this very, very narrow spectrum, the gravitational collision coalescence, because that's what matters for clouds. There will be always a little bit of the width, although very small, and this will produce these peaks. But the point is that there is nothing here. So this is basically just your adiabatic spectrum. The cutoff comes from the fact that you activate some and don't activate the other ones, and that's where your sharp cutoff comes from. Now, if I probably will not finish, but at least
we'll have a discussion.
Yeah. Now, if you allow what I call a large eddy hopping, in other words, those families of trajectories, this is the spectrum that you will get. So you still have the peak, which is considerably wider now, but you get a lot of smaller droplets. And that picture is kind of similar to the one that I showed you before from 20-some years old observation. So it's a realistic shape, it's broad, it's bimodal, dispersion is realistic, the dispersion, which is the width of the spectrum divided by the mean, that's kind of a realistic number. And then this is really not related to what I want to talk about. This is basically that this part, the coalescence, is accelerating the growth of these droplets because you get much more wider spectrum now, okay? So remember, I told you that condensation growth is reversible. Droplets grow more in higher S and then less in lower S, and the two situations change rapidly. Well, that's not really true when you think about entrainment and mixing and the large, what I call a larger dehopping, because that provides additional effects that contribute to the spectral width. Here, the thinking was within the volume that is, let's say, homogeneous on the average. Here, we're talking about entrainment mixing, we're talking about some fresh activation, so on and so forth. So I think this is where, when entrainment and mixing comes about very strongly to affect the droplet space. Now, about this collisional growth, I talk about that more. I talk about this in Potsdam, and then Liang Peng was here last time, and I'm sure he gave a seminar and presented some of the results. But this is something that we work on, and maybe the only thing I will show, I will skip those. I mean, these are those different effects, and then the numerical technique that we use is called hybrid DNS, that we basically combine a background turbulence flow with the flow describing interaction of droplets when they approach each other. And again, this is feasible because of some of the effects that I already mentioned at the beginning. The droplets are really far from each other and they really interact within the dissipation range. And the effects of droplets of turbulence is relatively minor. So all of those allow you to build a relatively straightforward, if you live within the Stokes limit, because if you go beyond Stokes, that is more difficult, and we haven't tried to use anything beyond Stokes now. But anyway, these numerical techniques will allow you to build collision kernels that you can then try to use in LES, and we haven't done it yet. Beyond just showing that turbulence probably has some important effect, I will not explain what I'm showing, but this is just a very idealized cloud simulation, basically a bubble that rises, produces condensation, then forms rain falls out to the ground, and then basically comparing simulation when there is no turbulence effect, and then when the added dissipation rate, the turbulence dissipation rate is kind of typical for clouds, is 100. And that's basically the evolution with time of the rain rate at the surface. So it's unrealistic to expect that all clouds will have the same dissipation rate, but at least that gives you kind of a feeling what you might expect when you include turbulence effects into collision coalescence. So that is idealized simulation using basically beam microphysics, in other words, looking how spectrum of droplets evolves and when how rain forms, so on and so forth. So there are a couple of things here to notice. First is that what we expected, and people actually start looking into this problem, because as you can see, the precipitation tends to develop earlier. Maybe 7-8 minutes earlier. But there is an additional effect, which is that the maximum surface precipitation rate is higher. And if you think how much rain there is on the surface from that small cloud, that's what it shows. So that's accumulation of precipitation at the surface. So as I said, the rain starts earlier, but also you have more rain from a single cloud. And if you think about it, that kind of makes sense. But honestly, I haven't expected this. We've been thinking always that this effect of producing earlier rain is kind of the motivation, because people tend to argue that rain in simulations or in nature, the rain in simulations without turbulence, without considering the effects of turbulence, forms later than one would expect, or it's difficult to estimate it from the observations, but there is a kind of a notion that the rain maybe needs 15 minutes to form, but again, the question is, where is the zero time for a cloud? So I'm done. I see that Grisha is kind of getting nervous, so I'm finished. So from basically a couple points, mostly turbulence seems to have a significant effect on diffusional growth of cloud droplets from this kind of homogeneous cloud point of view. turbulence seems to play a significant role when entrainment and mixing is considered through this mechanism that I call latcher dehopping. And again, local heterogeneity of mixing, that's something that I said, and it's difficult to quantify it from the observations, but also intraductivation. So arguably these two are part of this latcher dehopping, because they basically provide different histories. And then for the collisional growth, the small scale turbulence appears to have a significant effect on collisional growth. Not only rain to tends to form earlier in a single cloud, but also turbulent clouds seem to rain more. And that's something that this is just the idea that we throw in here, and we need to go and do large eddy simulations with realistic sort of clouds rather than just a bubble, and see whether this will really, how important that is, because of course the eddy dissipation rate will change as the cloud evolves, so on and so forth. So some initial studies like that have been done, but we need to do this more and more, and kind of convince ourselves that what we see in a model has something to do with the real world outside. So I guess I
so we may have, I don't know, a couple of questions. I mean, really, if somebody has questions, and then we can kind of finish it formal and start the discussion, which would be already separate. So if please ask about questions and not discussion. Is there no question?
Well, I have a question, which is not discussion. So in the latter part, when you talk about, you know, rain initiation and collision, I mean, those particles are huge. I mean, they're probably in 100 micron range, I mean, from your plot, or 50 microns.
Yeah.
They're large, so they have quite a decent Stokes number.
Yeah.
So they will show preferential concentration.
Yeah, and arguably that's what you see if you look at the rain falling from the sky, you get those streaks, am I right?
Yeah, but these guys, how long are they staying in the cloud before they actually come out of the cloud, before they're alone or interact with the falling droplets? I mean, they're quite for a long time in the cloud, right?
Yeah, and they go because they're actually falling through a cloud and collecting small cloud droplets.
Right, but in addition, you have turbulence. I mean, you just showed us that turbulence leads to a stronger rainfall.
Yeah, but that's
you would expect.
So yeah, but that's
the reason for the stronger rainfall, in your opinion.
Well, because first of all, I mean, typically what we tend to think is that you know, how you get this 100 micron drop. Okay, once you get it, it's kind of done. Then it falls and collects and grows more. But I think you get more of those 100 micron droplets to begin with through this mechanism that I presented. And actually, yeah. No. The fact that locally, if you think about droplet collisions through DNS, we're only looking at very small scales. And the argument is that these small droplets, you know, 10, 15, 20 microns, they will collide with each other more efficiently with turbulence. Because they're not only gravitational collisions, but it's modified. And actually, I went too fast, but I get basically three mechanisms where turbulence affects droplets. So it locally changes droplet concentration. That's the preferential concentration. And I showed you already some effect that by eye you can see. And of course that increases because this is n squared kind of problem. So that's locally you increase. Then droplets collide differently when you get turbulence. Normally you think about kind of sedimentation as the primary mechanism. Now that's modified. So these, from a modeling point of view, these were studied because these are what we call a geometric collisions. You don't really have to include hydrodynamic interaction. This one is more difficult.
And which one is more important in your numerics?
Well,
which one of three gives the main contribution? You can separate the numerics.
No, I know. But I'm not ready to answer that. I would need to go to the papers and look carefully. But I think the one thing that I remember,
the preferential concentration plays no role here. You cannot claim the
No, not for the collisional growth. For the collisional growth.
Okay. So, I mean, let's finish formally the session.